So I hope that my students will read widely and read about people unlike themselves, just so we can all learn to be more human and more kind.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Chalk and Ink, the podcast for teachers who write and writers who teach. Today, I have a real treat for you, an interview with talented and gifted elementary school teacher and picture book author, Brenda Meyer. Not only does Brenda share some great ways to push learners in your classroom, she also gives some great tips for how to make time for writing while teaching full-time and raising five kids. Happy listening. Welcome, Brenda. We're so glad to have you on the podcast with us today. Thank you so much for being here. And I would love it if you would go ahead and tell us a little bit about who you are as a teacher and who you are as a writer.
Well, hi, Kate. It's great to be here. My name is Brenda Meyer, and I am a gifted education specialist or a teacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I'm also a picture book author.
That's awesome. Would you please tell us about your picture book titles?
Yes, I have two, and then my third one is upcoming. My first one is called The Little Red Fort from Scholastic Press, and the second one is called Peeping Beauty from Simon & Schuster. And my third one is a follow-up to The Little Red Fort called The Little Blue Bridge, and it will be out in April of 21.
I'm really excited for that book. I can't wait to read it.
Thanks. Me too. It's supposed to be in the book fair, if we even have book fairs in the spring.
Oh my gosh, that would be so exciting if it was in the book fair.
Yeah, it is. It's set for the book fair. But with the pandemic, I just don't know how that's going to affect it.
Right. Well, maybe even if, you know, with the pandemic, even if people are virtual, maybe there's some way they could still have the book fair.
Yeah, they can do online ordering. But you have to have a code, and the teacher has to send the code out. And I worry that it could be more difficult for people without access to technology. But yeah, it'll still be there.
No, that's true. I mean, it's much better in person, because then you don't have to worry about the technology access, but you also don't have to worry about people just not knowing about it because they haven't, you know, read about it. They didn't read the class newsletter, or they missed the announcement. So it's definitely better to have it in person where you can actually see the books.
Yeah. And shop. Because who doesn't like to shop, right? Shop for books.
That is my all-time favorite pastime. I know on your website, you said that you had 6 books as a child growing up. So, and you must shop for books a lot these days.
I do, but I'm afraid I haven't been doing as much during the pandemic. When someone tells me about a book, I might order it and have it sent to the house, but I haven't been going into bookstores, so I feel like I'm really out of the loop the last few months.
No, that's true. It's definitely harder not being able to go into a bookstore or not being able to go into a library, too.
Yeah, I miss it. I miss it.
Yeah, I really miss it, too. So which came first for you, the passion for teaching or the passion for writing?
I think it was about the same time, really. I was in first grade, about 6 years old. And I, back then we didn't read a lot until first grade. And I just really loved my teacher. And so I thought it might be fun to be a teacher. And I didn't know I was going to be a writer, but I really liked, I'd have to say teaching. I mean, I loved reading at that age, but I hadn't really thought I might be a writer. Both of those things popped in my head off and on over the years, but I didn't think either one of them was something that I could actually do.
You know, I've heard a lot of people say that about writing, that they did not realize it was a profession. Do you think that's what it was for you too?
No, I thought I didn't have a lot of, oh gosh, you don't want to hear this, but I didn't have a lot of attention at home. You know, my mom was a single mom. She was very busy. You'd probably would call her neglectful. But I mean, she did what she had to do. I just didn't really realize that I was smart enough that I could, you know, go to college or be a teacher or be an author. I thought that was something other people did. I didn't have that, you know, reinforcement from a parent that you hopefully children have to follow their dreams. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You are a very brilliant, kind, generous person. So thank goodness you made it into the teaching profession and the writing world so we can all benefit from your wisdom. I'm so glad that it worked out that way.
Well, right back at you, Kate.
Thanks, Brenda. How does teaching affect your writing?
Well, I think, I think when I'm writing, I write what inspires me, but I also, there's this teacher part of my brain that's always on, that's always thinking, is this something a teacher could use in the classroom? Because our time as teachers is so limited that I'm hopefully, the story will have layers where you can use it. I don't want to say to hit an objective, but that you could justify it. Like I wrote Peeping Beauty and it came out how it came out. But then there was this teacher part of me going, life cycles. First grade does life cycles, you know? So I'm always thinking about that, but I don't really put it in there intentionally. But then after I write the story, I start looking for that. If I could highlight it a little more, I certainly would. That's probably definitely the teacher part of me.
No, I think that's totally true. You write from a place of inspiration, but then you're going to go back and you're going to look at it with a different eye than someone who isn't in the classroom all the time.
Yeah, because as teachers, we have to be very efficient with our time. And if it you know, covers multiple things, that gives us it's much more efficient.
Right, because then you can teach a couple lessons with one book instead of only getting one lesson from a book.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And how about the other way? How does your writing affect your teaching?
You know, I was thinking about that, and I hadn't given it a whole lot of thought, but a couple of things did come to mind. I have taken a passage that I enjoyed. When a student didn't understand different tenses, I would take a passage and show it to the student. And then I realized, hey, this is a great learning thing. So I started taking passages from stories and asking the kids, what tense is it? And then inviting them to try to change tense, or explaining that to them. When we were talking about how in advertising you're manipulated, and even when you're writing, when you're reading, sometimes there is a slant, especially, you know, if it's a narrative text, sometimes you might have an unreliable narrator. And so there's like a slant to the story that character is telling you. And to give a student something like a passage from something that has a slant to, and ask them, you know, discuss it, analyze that, and then ask them to rewrite it from someone else's point of view in the story, maybe another character's point of view. Go ahead.
That's really powerful to have students rewrite stories from a different point of view.
Yeah. I also did, just for kicks, a couple of times, have some little kids. They didn't understand about skit. Like a skit, like a play format. And mm-hmm. So we took folk tales, and I would give them part of a folk tale. They had to dictate it to me. They were pretty little. And we would read the folk tale, and then they would dictate to me how to turn it into a script, and how you do, you know, the actions in parentheses, and how you put the character out in front with a colon. And so that was kind of fun too, then they tried to do it on their own, but like that translation from just a narrative text to a different format. If there's anything like that, that would be fun too.
Definitely. You know, what you were saying earlier about perspective makes me think about the author's purpose. You know, not only just an unreliable narrator, but every author has a purpose when he or she writes a book. And so I was wondering if you also talk about that with your students when you're talking about different perspectives.
Yeah, sometimes they cover that a lot in the regular classroom. And so in my gifted work, a lot of times I try to do something that they're not also doing in the classroom, but I do tend to gravitate towards looking at perspectives, in lots of different situations and changes over time and just different things to add depth or complexity to whatever it is we're doing.
Well, I'm sure they really benefit from your expertise, because I'm sure you're looking at that from a writer's lens while you're teaching. So I'm sure they get it in a different way than they would from someone who didn't have your experience as a writer.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think so for sure. Tell us about a breakthrough moment you had in your writing.
I would say it was my very first critique at an SCBWI conference. It was actually my second conference. I went to one in the fall, and then I came back in the spring, and I had brought my first manuscript, my first picture book manuscript. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to do this thing. But then one of the editors picked her two favorites, and those people got to come get a personal face-to-face critique. And I was one of those people with my very first manuscript. And she didn't offer to buy it, but she said to me these words, "You need to get an agent." And I thought,
wow.
I don't know how, I don't care how long it's going to take, but I will keep trying and I will do this. And I think that that was just a life-changing moment for me, just that little bit of hope that she gave me. So I thought, I will do this. I will persevere until I do it. And at that moment, you know, I didn't know before that if I was going to be able to do this. But when she said those words to me, I thought, okay, I can do this. It may take years, but I can do this.
Well, definitely. I mean, to be picked out an SCBWI conference, that's huge.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, to be singled out like that, that's fantastic. That must have been a really exciting day.
It was a really exciting day. But of course, there were older, more experienced people. I mean, like, now don't get excited, Brenda. Doesn't mean she's going to buy it.
Well, you have to get excited about the small things in life. If you only get excited about the big things, that's a pretty dull way to live life.
I agree with you. I did get excited.
Oh my gosh, that's just fantastic. So do you, are you heavily involved in your local SCBWI chapter?
I haven't been, yes, I always go to the conferences. I haven't been as involved the last year or so because I've just been too busy to go to every monthly meeting. But yes, I definitely go to our conferences. I find that once you get to a certain point, it's almost like you need like an advanced retreat.
Yes.
Because I find that when I go, I'm doing more teaching than I am getting something out of it. And so I'm sort of transitioning to spending more time with critiquing with my peers who have already gotten going, because I spend enough of my time teaching. And I want to give back, but I can't just give back. I need to be getting something too.
Definitely.
That sounds really tacky, but I mean, it's just a very practical consideration. I'm going to keep going and everything, but I need to be growing as well.
Definitely. And I do think that as teachers, we spend a lot of our time teaching. And so I think...
Yeah. And doing stuff for free off the clock. And
yes, exactly. And so I do think that that gets tiring then to be doing that outside of the job as well.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, it's just such a great feeling, though. Some of my favorite memories are with my friends being, you know, down in the writing trenches, hanging out at the conferences and socializing and going to dinner and commiserating about our critiques. And there's just something about that sorority, that camaraderie.
No, it's true. It's really wonderful to be with other writers and other people who are passionate about the same topics, for sure.
Yeah, I do miss it during the pandemic.
Yeah, me too. I definitely miss that face-to-face contact. Tell us about a breakthrough moment you had in your teaching.
Oh. It was probably actually with my own children. The first one that pops into my mind anyway, so that I don't waste your time. I was a classroom teacher. I taught first, second, and third grade for several years. And then I stayed home to have my children, because Oklahoma pays teachers so little that once we had two kids, I was giving all my money away to a babysitter, so I didn't really pay to. So I stayed home, and my son was three, and he was out writing words on the sidewalk. And so I called over to the pre-K to talk to them. This is my first kid. You know how you are with your first kid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so what's the reading and writing program like at the school for pre-K students? And she was like, that's not developmentally appropriate. And I'm like, well, apparently it is for him, because I'm just standing there watching him write all these words on the side about perfectly spelled. And that's when I really started getting interested in gifted education, because I thought we put him in pre-K and he was doing things he could have done 2 years before. And
right.
So he was starting to hate school. And so I thought that really became my driving passion. When I went back to get my master's, I also got my gifted certification, because I thought, I want to help these kids who don't get to learn something new every day. Everyone should get to learn something new every day. It's kind of like when we go to a critique and your peers say, oh, it's so good, Kay, that's great. And you're like, that's not helpful. I'm not learning anything when you tell me that. Kids are the
it's
same
true.
Way. I want them to get to learn and grow every day too. So that was probably it, when I realized, oh, this isn't normal. There are kids that aren't getting what they need.
Yeah, that sounds like a very powerful moment for sure. You know, that's something I talk a lot about in my classroom. When kids are anxious about having their work critiqued, I try to frame it as it's a gift to get a critique. It's not a criticism. It's a way to make yourself stronger and a better writer. And if people didn't believe in you, then they wouldn't be giving you a critique. And it really changes things for my students. I feel they're much more open to feedback when they look at it as a gift instead of as a criticism.
Yeah, it's probably like when we got our first critiques at a conference. I don't know about you, but I know I cried when I got my first one that wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. But there's always some nugget of truth in there, something that you can learn and grow from. And now, as an agented author, when I first got rejections, I would cry. I would be depressed for 2 days. And now I just look at that as, you know, like you said, a positive criticism, something that I can get, learn, something I can grow from. Exactly. And now when I get them, I'm like, yeah, you know, if two people say that, I'll listen to them.
No, that's true too. I mean, you also learn that the more people say something, the more it's really important to take heed and make a change. I share the same thing with my students. My critique group, my very first one, was 35 minutes away from my house. And I used to spend the whole way home crying as I drove from critique group back to my house. But now I really enjoy it. And it's exactly as you said, I don't want to hear what's good about it. I want to hear how I can make it stronger. So it's a completely different shift.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little insecure. I do want to hear what's good about it, but I also do want to, I want to grow too.
Well, I don't know. I like to hear what's good about it also, but sometimes, you know, I just know something's not working and I don't know. I just need something different. And oftentimes in my critique group, I'll find that someone will find something and then everyone will be like, oh yeah, that's it. That's why it's not working. And so it's really helpful to move away and sometimes from what is working so that we can actually go into what's not working in case it's not obvious right away.
Yeah. And that collective brain, again, it's just like in school, when you get those discussions going, they're so much more valuable when you have that many more brains involved.
It's true. Now, how big are the groups that you're working with?
Well, I'm going to have to go by spring because I don't know about this year yet. I had four in kindergarten and I had about 30 in fifth grade. So I split those into two groups. So I'd have 15 usually.
Okay. So sometimes that's a pretty big group discussion if you're working with 15.
It really is because these are, it really is because these are the kids who are the ones who in your class, they want to talk all the time.
Right.
And I need to give them a chance to do that.
So what, if you have a kindergarten group with four students, and then you have a fifth grade group with 15 students, is that, you must be using two very different teaching skills with that wide of a range of students and also with the size of the group.
Yeah, definitely. I've tried to block all that out till I get finished with testing, but definitely. I mean, I feel like with the little kids, it's almost like, you're part mom and part teacher because, you know, you've got to, they just don't know so much about life yet. So they don't have the prerequisite skills to even really do sometimes discussion. You have to work on, you know, basic things like that, taking turns.
Right. A lot of routine teaching.
Yeah.
I know in some of your other interviews that I read, you talk about balancing teaching and writing. And I thought what you had to say was really wise. And I was hoping you would talk to us about that.
Really? What did I say? That was wise?
You said a lot of really wise things.
Really?
So yes.
Can you enlighten me what it might've been?
Well, I liked a couple different things.
How long ago was this interview? If it was before last week, I probably don't remember.
Okay. So I'll refresh you, Brenda. Okay. So when you were interviewed by Valerie Lawson, you said
Valerie.
Yeah.
She's in my critique group.
All right. You said, if it's important to you, you'll find a way to do it.
That's true.
And I thought, you know, that's so powerful. We make time for what's important. And going along with that, when you were interviewed by Maria Marshall, you said, I snatch time to write whenever I can.
Yes.
And then another thing that you said, and I think this was on Sensations, was you talked about how, like, in the summer, you might have a writing schedule, but during the school year, you didn't. And I've just found that that's something that I've had to accept, that, you know, during the summer, I can have a writing schedule, but during the school year, I have to accept that some days I'm going to be able to write, and maybe some days I won't be able to write, and that that is okay. It doesn't mean that I'm a failure if I don't write one day. And I thought I would just love to hear your take on that.
No, that, I mean, all those things are true. I have to get up at 4:50 every morning to be able to do what I need to do before work and to get to work by 7:15, which is my when my contract time begins. But because of that, I am home by a little after 3 o'clock. But okay. Then I have 5 children. Now, thankfully, 2 of them have just gone to college. Well, because of the pandemic, I'm going to take back the thankfully part, because I'm a little concerned about them being in OU's dorm right now. But yeah, they're telling me all kinds of stories that they're hearing.
Oh, no.
So, but with 5 people still at home, that I have to make dinner and do laundry. And yes, I should have my kids do more. And yes, they do have chores, but then they've got their own homework that I sometimes assist with. And so, you know, as a mom and a teacher and an author, the family comes first, and then the paying job comes. And then then the writing, you know, it's when, if you really value it, you're going to have to make room for it. So I do sometimes on a weekend when it's not during a pandemic, I will get up at 7 o'clock and go down to Panera down the street when they open, while all my family's sleeping in, mm-hmm. and hang out at Panera for a few hours writing. Or yeah. I'll go to bed and bring my laptop. Of course, I fall asleep 2 sentences in.
Right.
Or I'll print something, a story off, and take it to bed and edit it before I fall asleep. Or, you know, just the family's watching a movie and I've seen the movie, or I don't care about the movie. I will go in another room and write. So I would say one of the things that I don't do as often as a lot of people is I don't watch a lot of TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not, you know, I can turn on the news when I'm doing the treadmill in the morning, but it's just not something that I love TV. I love it as much as anyone. But if you want to write, you have to cut something out. And it's either going to be TV, it's going to be sleep. And I'd rather, right. you know, it does cut into my sleep, but teaching cuts into sleep too, you know, all those things that you have to do to prepare for teaching. So cutting out TV a lot of the time is what I do. And then on holidays, I'll binge watch something. So just any bit of time that you can get here and there, and making sure you have those times with your critique group. I critique most Sundays now via Zoom with my friends, because that keeps us accountable and it keeps me mm-hmm. doing something. And even if I didn't get to write anything that week, I'm critiquing their work, which keeps my brain sharp in, you know, for in that area.
Definitely. I mean, I think critiquing is super important. For me, I find the best work I get done is early in the morning. But as you said, that means getting up really early, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes I need to sleep or exercise at that time. But yeah, I'm definitely a 4 o'clock morning person myself.
Yeah. If I wanted to write in the morning, I would have to get up at least 4 o'clock. So I don't normally have time to do that in the morning, because I've started exercising in the morning. Because I'm mm-hmm. too tired after school. So it's usually the weekends or after everyone's eaten dinner and they're doing their thing, if I can get away. I'm lucky now that my kids are a little bit older and self-sufficient. I didn't really write until my youngest was in kindergarten, and he just turned 13. So they're okay. 13, they're 13 to 21.
Okay. So you've been writing for 10 years.
I would say 8, 7.
Eight.
No, okay. No, wait, hold on. That first critique was 2012.
Okay.
So 8, a little more than 8, actually. A little more than
okay.
8. I think that first year I was messing around with YA. And then that
okay.
was my first picture book in 2012. My first picture book manuscript.
I see.
Yeah, 8 years. And then it took 5 years for it to actually come out. From the time the editor first saw it to when it came out in the book fairs was 5 years.
5 years. Wow, that's a long time.
And then the second book was sold during that time, but it had to get in line behind the debut because, you know, the debut, I guess, is a thing.
Okay.
But so it happened really fast in the beginning, but then there was this really long wait, hurry up and wait, you know?
Right. Yeah. But that was really fast that you got published. That's awesome.
Oh, well, thanks. But then, you know, I'll go a very long time with no interest in anything. So.
Well, that's just how it goes, I think.
Yeah. Just gotta persevere.
Definitely.
We all can't be, you know, Tammy Sauer and Ryan T. Higgins.
All those
brilliant people like that.
No, that's true. There are a lot of brilliant people out there for sure. So, but I think every author brings something different. So,
Definitely.
Yeah. So what advice do you have for teachers who want to write? Because I think oftentimes teachers as a group are a very creative set of people, but oftentimes put their job, put so much effort into their job that they don't then put effort into their own creativity, but yet they want to. So what advice do you have specifically for teachers?
Well, like we've been talking about, if it is important enough to you, you will not make an excuse. You will find a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
And get a critique group and read lots of things, read lots of things written in the last 5 years, current as you can get them. Of course, don't write to trends, just write don't add to any crap that's out there. Add something that you think is not out there and that you think is valuable.
Yeah, I think that's, really important that you mentioned to read what's in the past 5 years. I've heard even read what's in the past 2 years.
Yeah, I think I heard that too.
I think a lot of people don't realize that, they'll say, well, whatever, Good Night Moon, this is just like Good Night Moon, without realizing Good Night Moon is, 80 years old. So I think that's really important that people, if they do want to do their own writing and they want to understand what's getting published, it's not looking at classics. It's looking at what's been published in the past couple of years.
Yeah. I don't have I read Good Night Moon a lot too. I still have a copy of it on the shelf, but you want to definitely read the current things because Good Night Moon might not have sold today. I mean, I would like to think it would, but if it were coming out now, it might not have sold. So read the things that are selling now if you want to sell something.
Yeah, definitely. What's one writing exercise or activity that you can share with our listeners that they might want to try out in their own classrooms?
I would say the perspectives thing. I really like that one. Taking a passage that maybe has a character's opinion in it or slant in it that isn't quite objective, and then pick another character and say, what would that character say about it? What do you think this one would say about it? And just rewrite it. Ooh, you could even do it like have the kids read it and see if the other kids can figure out whose perspective it is to see how well they know the characterization.
That would be super fun.
I don't know. I'm just making this up.
That would be really fun though. So do you feel that when you're looking at different perspectives that it also helps kids with social emotional learning?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Because we have a duty, I think, to society, to each other, to think about other people's perspectives. I mean, we can't all just go around thinking about ourselves. We try to teach toddlers not to do that. And now I feel like we have to teach adults not to just think about themselves. So in school, I definitely feel that pressure to make sure that they look at different perspectives, because then one, they'll learn about their fellow human beings. But also I hope it will also facilitate them thinking for themselves, Oh, well, this person thinks this because of this situation they're in, or this person does because of this, just a little more critical thinking.
Yes. I think critical thinking it's incredibly important. And I think in order to be citizens, people have to know how to think critically, and that we can't start that early enough or do it often enough.
And that's what's so great about books. I remember when I first read Esperanza Rising, that book made me feel like I was that little girl. Now I'm a white girl from South Tulsa. I grew up poor, but I had could never I couldn't imagine what it was like to be a little girl from Mexico, a wealthy girl from Mexico who lost everything in the 30s and ended up, you know, doing manual labor in California. So, but through that book, I did get that perspective. I could kind of, in a way, understand that character, that person, as much as I ever could hope to, at least. And I think that's what books do for us, help us see those different perspectives. So I hope that my students will read widely and read about people unlike themselves, just so we can all learn to be more human and more kind.
Yes, I think it's so important when we're talking about books, you know, to talk about windows and mirrors. Where do we see ourselves and where do we have a window into someone else's experience?
Mm-hmm.
So important.
I agree, yeah.
So just for fun, thinking of a book that you haven't written, that someone else has written, what's one book that you think every elementary teacher should have in their classroom if they don't already have it?
Well, first off, Kate, I think it's really cruel that you said one.
Okay, you can say 10 if you want, or 20. Okay.
I have four. I have four that I went and just that popped into my head. What If by Samantha Berger, illustrated by Mike Curato. It is something, at the beginning of the year, I always try to do something on social, emotional learning. And this one is really about resilience. And if you haven't checked it out, What If? It's
all right.
It's a brilliant book, Little Brown. And there's a backstory to that she has like on the jacket at the back about why she wrote this story. It's just,
Now I'm intrigued.
Yeah. And then Juana Martinez Neal, who was in our debut group with us.
Yep.
The Alma and How She Got Her Name. I think that would be a really great story at the beginning of the year for making sure that every child knows he or she gets to tell his or her own story. And it speaks to the potential that we all have, whether we have been told that at home or not.
I love that book.
Yeah. And then The Wall in the Middle of the Book by John, I don't know how you say his last name, A-G-E-E.
Okay.
I love it because of the discussions about the assumptions that we might make about the characters, but what we think we know and is going on, and then what's really going on, and how we tend to judge people, maybe not always fairly.
He has an amazing body of work.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. This is just a really funny title. And then the last one that I chose is We Are Grateful, O.J. Lee Valiga, by one of our debut group partners, Tracy Sorrell, illustrated by Frene Lesek. And I just think not only is it a lovely book and has won tons of awards, but it's just, it's deceptively simple the way it goes through the year, this very lyrical story. These people are going through the year talking about the things in their lives that are important, but it's from a different perspective. It's from her perspective as a Cherokee Nation citizen. And there are little treasures on every page, things that, like, yeah, I don't even want to tell because that's kind of her story to tell, but there are so many little just precious things on every page that I wouldn't have known and I wouldn't have been able to relate to, but I love seeing that from someone else's perspective, how she might see the seasons. And again, speaking to perspectives for children, they should read about people who are not living the same life that they're living, who aren't who are different from themselves. You know, we should all learn from each other.
Definitely. It's so true. I love in that book how she talks about how originally there was an owl, and she said, no, we absolutely cannot have an owl in this book. And I thought, that is really fascinating to me. Instead, the woodpecker, you know, I love that. I really learned from that. And I thought, that is so important, right? For me, yes. I love owls. Like, I consider them like a sign of good luck. And you know, in this other culture, they're not a sign of good luck. And just something as simple as an owl, right, means something really different depending on what culture we come from.
Yes, and I didn't realize that in Cherokee culture, it's generally the father who sings lullabies to the children and the grandmother who gives you your Cherokee name and just all these things. I mean, right here in Oklahoma, I mean, I am right here in Indian country and I did not know that.
Well, I just think that just goes to show that we need a lot of a lot more books from mm-hmm. people from all different backgrounds. And when yes. we get books like that, that's an opportunity to learn because
yes. we need representation of everyone.
We do. And it's lacking for sure.
It is. And we'll probably be able to read the rest of our lives and not learn everything that we should have learned because of the dearth of information and books out there from more people. So I think, I'm really grateful we're getting more and more representation. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. We do a Project Lit chapter at my school, so I'm really excited about that. And it's our third year, so it's really a chance to bring some different perspectives in literature, you know, introduce those perspectives to the kids at our school. So it's really been a pretty phenomenal experience.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, it has been. So, well, I want to thank you for your time today. It's been so great to talk with you, and I've learned so much, and I can't wait to check out some of those titles that you mentioned. And I'm really excited to try a perspective exercise with my students now.
Oh, well, thanks, Kate. I appreciate chatting with you. It's always fun talking to you.
Yeah, it's been great. So I wish you the best of luck with the rest of your school year.
Oh, you as well, since it was just started today.
Yeah, we just started. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate.
All right. Take care, Brenda.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone, to the second episode of Chalk and Ink. We'll be back again in 2 weeks. In the meantime, you can get Chalk and Ink from wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Happy writing!